Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hey, Zach.
Well, it's the heart of the hurricane season, and it looks like a big storm could hit Florida for the third year in a row. We'll talk about the looming threat of Hurricane Dorian and what Florida's elected leaders are doing to prepare for the storm. We'll also touch on the state's plan to build three controversial new toll roads, which kicked off this week with a series of meetings. All that and more is coming up, but first, you all know what that music means. It's time for our Pick a Number segment. John, did you come armed with a number this week?
I sure did, Zach. I'm a little early for Nigel Tufnell Day, but I'm going with a This Is Spinal Tap reference with my number today, which is 11.
Nice, nice. The secret weapon. The amp goes all the way up to 11. All right, I can top that one. My number is 20,000. So that's John with an 11 and me, Zach Anderson, with a 20,000. Write those numbers down, folks, and we'll come back to them at the end of the show and tell you what they mean for Florida politics. We're going to start this week by talking about Hurricane Dorian, because when there's a hurricane threatening Florida, there is no bigger news. The most important responsibility for any elected official is keeping people safe. And in Florida, a big part of keeping people safe is ensuring that they have the best information and emergency services when a hurricane is threatening. This is really, for Governor Ron DeSantis, just a huge test of leadership, and really for elected leaders at all level. This is the first time that DeSantis has been in charge when a hurricane is headed towards Florida. We should note that we're recording this on Thursday at 10 a.m., and right now Dorian is projected to make landfall somewhere on the east coast of Florida early next week as a major, very destructive hurricane. If you're listening to this podcast and you live on the east coast of Florida, or really anywhere in Florida, you should be taking this storm extremely seriously. It is a life-threatening event. That's the message that the governor has been sending. He started tweeting about Dorian on Monday, telling Floridians to pay attention when it was kind of a disorganized tropical storm. Things have really ramped up rapidly since then, and DeSantis officially declared a state of emergency in Florida or in a number of Florida counties yesterday. John, tell us what the governor and other state leaders have been doing to get Florida ready for this storm.
Well, DeSantis has declared a state of emergency. That's pretty much of a standard thing that comes along about now. He's spoken with President Trump, who's assured him that the federal government stands ready to help. And he's told Floridians on the East Coast, as you mentioned, that they should have 7 days supply ready in advance of the storm. The Emergency Operations Center in Tallahassee has been activated, but it's still at a early stage level. There's talk of school closings and football cancellations in the air. Attorney General Ashley Moody, she's activated the price gouging hotline, ready to crack down on anyone trying to raise prices to take advantage of storm shortages, which can occur more typically post-hurricane. But as all told, you know, it's a very familiar planning stage. Anyone in Florida who has ever watched water bottles and natural gas containers fly off the shelves at Publix, they can appreciate. Undoubtedly, DeSantis is going to spend a lot of time this weekend at the state's Emergency Operations Center doing periodic updates as the storm nears.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, this is most Floridians and really the state government. I mean, does this sort of run on autopilot to some degree? Whatever governor is in there, you have a lot of professional people who have gone through a lot of these hurricanes. You have staging areas set up in Florida. They have a plan of action. It's really just sort of executing it, right?
Yeah, it's you know, there's a new emergency operations leader, Jared Moskowitz. He was appointed by DeSantis earlier this year. He's you know, a professional. He's been in the disaster recovery business, admittedly, as a lawyer and business development guy. But, you know, there seems to be a confidence that he knows what he's doing. But, you know, really, there's only so much on paper that you know, officials can do. Circumstances can complicate things, and it's important for leaders to look busy. You know, we remember former Governor Scott was always on TV with his Navy baseball cap, and Jeb Bush once brought his brother, the president, down to hand out ice. Of course, that was in 2004, a presidential year. DeSantis, though, is going to probably start looking, you know, even more engaged as Dorian edges closer.
Right, right. And that's the other element of this here. Obviously, it's kind of all hands on deck and just trying to keep people safe and make sure that they get emergency services. But this is also a test of leadership. This is something that, you know, that people remember about a governor. It's still kind of very early to say what any political ramifications of this storm could be, but there's no question that a major disaster like a hurricane hitting your state can really define a governor's legacy. You know, what DeSantis does now, whether he, you know, executes this plan addresses any, you know, kind of problems that arise, could really stick with him for a long time. Former Governor Jeb Bush was thrust into the spotlight when 8 hurricanes hit Florida between 2004 and 2005. And he generally received really positive reviews for the state's response to those hurricanes. And he touted that reputation as a solid leader in a time of crisis when he ran for president in 2016. I covered one of Bush's presidential campaign stops down in Charlotte County over here in Southwest Florida. That area was really devastated by Hurricane Charley in 2004, really a very, very strong storm that came up. It was almost like a big tornado came right up the Peace River and just obliterated a big swath of Charlotte County. Bush was on the ground immediately. I think he got his brother, the president, down there. And he was eager to talk about Charlie during the presidential campaign stop and when he came through Port Charlotte. Even though that hurricane had hit more than a decade prior, it really evoked memories of him as a strong leader. And it just goes to show how these events can live with you for a long, long time as an elected official. Former Governor Rick Scott realized how important it was to show leadership during hurricanes. I remember during Irma in 2017, he was everywhere in his Navy hat, urging Floridians to be prepared, and then traveling around the state after the storm hit to assess the damage. You knew when he put that Navy hat on that things were getting serious here. But, you know, just because he was really proactive, it didn't stop him from being criticized when there was a series of deaths in a nursing home down in Broward County that lost power during Hurricane Irma and really experienced very sweltering conditions that proved fatal for some of the residents in that nursing home. And the aftermath of that continues to play out in lawsuits and things. And, you know, there's been back and forth between the governor and the owners of that nursing home about, you know, whether who did what and what kind of help should have been available. When Hurricane Michael hit the panhandle during the closing stretch of Scott's U.S. Senate campaign last year, he stopped much of his regular campaign activity in the final month of the race to focus on storm recovery. Not doing that could have left him open to criticism that he wasn't doing enough to help the panhandle. But focusing on the storm also was kind of viewed as a little bit of a political boost that allowed him to project a strong image. So there's really political opportunities from these storms, but also political peril that comes from having a major screw-up on your watch, potentially. People are pretty quick to complain if they're without electricity for a long time or aid doesn't arrive quickly enough. John, do you think that Governor DeSantis realizes how important it is for him to do his job well right now and get the state prepared?
Yeah, it's funny. It's this may be DeSantis's first hurricane as governor, but as you indicated there, I think anyone who gets into politics has sort of an innate understanding of the political risk and reward of these storms. You know, the risk is if anything very bad happens and the state looks unprepared, you're going to catch heat. You know, it's funny. Some time ago, I spoke with former State Emergency Management Division Director Craig Fugate. He told me a little while ago about what the political risk was. Here's some sound from Fugate.
Disasters are not kind to governors, and you don't get a do-over.
Okay, well, Fugate went on to be the Federal Emergency Management Agency head under both President George W. Bush and President Obama. So he's got, you know, a bipartisan familiarity with disasters. The rewards of a storm for an elected official mostly come when things go smoothly. There's no major loss of life or individual case of incompetence, you know, maybe like what you're indicating there with the nursing home in Broward County. And then when disaster cleanup goes well, people get their power back on in short order and have a relatively decent experience with their insurance company. Florida's got a lot of experience with storms, and it's really just a matter of you know, where does it go from here? And I think DeSantis is you know, stepping up, and he's kind of ready to realize, and he's got a pretty strong professional staff behind him right now.
Yeah, so far as governor, he's been very proactive. I mean, he really hit the ground running. He was a whirlwind of activity, and I'm not talking about during the hurricane here, but just in general, you know, like the first few weeks of his administration were just issue after issue, him, you know, hitting them hard and really taking decisive action. So it stands to reason that this is, he seems like a governor who is ready to jump into action quickly. I mean, there's some risk from that as well, though. I mean, if you're, you know, John and I were talking about this before the show, you know, if you evacuate people too early, you know, you can cause a big traffic jam on the road. You know, right now, this hurricane, where it's going to hit is really uncertain. I mean, the cone of uncertainty is really encompassing the entire state of Florida right now. And, you know, it's not going to hit. It's not such a massive hurricane like Hurricane Irma, where it's going to hit the whole state at once. This is a much smaller storm. In the end, you know, the eyewall is probably going to affect an area that's only a few miles wide or maybe tens of miles at the most. But, you know, right now, if you're in Miami, you're kind of freaking out. If you're in Jacksonville, you're kind of freaking out because it could hit either of those areas. But at some point, it's going to narrow in. And so it's a bit of a waiting game here. And you got to try and get it just right where you're not causing people to panic and evacuate when maybe the storm is going to go somewhere 200 miles away. John, I mean, can you talk about that? I mean, it's sort of you have to have a bit of common sense you know, kind of a good gut feeling about these things and not pull the trigger too early, right?
Yeah, you know, we all recall when Governor Scott, you know, prodded everybody to leave the state back in 2017 when Hurricane Irma was coming through.
It was kind of a mess.
It was kind of a mess. People were stuck in traffic. Hotels were way overcrowded. People were, you know, finding themselves in, you know, Moultrie, Georgia or something like that, looking for a hotel. And I don't know, you know, was that the way to approach this storm or at that time anyway?
Right. He avoided criticism that he didn't wait too long, but at the same time, you complicate things. But I guess with Irma, it was a little bit different too, because that was such a huge storm that it really affected a huge area. But, yeah. You know, if it was a, you know, if he had done that with a different storm and it hit just a confined area, I think he would have probably gotten more blowback. I don't know that he got that much blowback because Irma ended up affecting such a large swath of the state. But, you know, for a storm like this, if you pull the trigger too early, you might get some folks who said, well, you told me to evacuate and it came nowhere near me. So,
and the Irma response also kind of belied what was the traditional approach to hurricanes in Florida, which is what, shelter in place. The right. idea of no, get on the road and try to evacuate. Sure. That has become something of the, maybe the new normal or something like that, whether it's right or not.
Yeah. There were people in Sarasota who drove all the way up to Atlanta, who drove a whole day to get away from this storm. And in the end, they were frustrated that they couldn't get back right away because of the traffic jams and things like that to check on their property and, you know, to do some of the things that they needed to do. So again, this is not an easy call. You know, it's very easy for an elected official to overreact, underreact, and you're going to get criticism either way. So we'll see how this all plays out. But lastly, we're going to switch topics here from Hurricane Dorian to the largest expansion of Florida's highway system since the 1950s. Speaking of evacuations, one of the arguments used for this highway expansion has been hurricane evacuation and the need to have more hurricane evacuation routes. Earlier this year, the legislature approved three new toll roads that will stretch across rural areas of Florida. The bill set up three task forces that are charged with figuring out exactly what routes the new roads will take. Those task forces began meeting this week. John, you were covering those meetings. Can you tell me a little bit what they were like? Did they get off to a good start?
Yeah, well, you had these three separate task forces meeting for the first time in Tampa this week, and they began analyzing. This is going to be 330 miles of proposed new toll roads, three different projects, the biggest one taking the Tampa area Suncoast Parkway all the way to Georgia. That's the one that has sort of some of its roots in the idea of hurricane evacuation. And then there's another big road linking Lakeland with the Naples area. Senate President Bill Galvano, he is a Bradenton Republican. He pushed the idea through the legislature last spring with the support of business and road builder associations, and very much over the opposition of environmental groups and planning organizations. He sort of opened these task forces with some big picture guidelines, but those questioning whether these three new toll roads should even be built, I think they came away from these meetings alarmed at the tone of the opening round of discussion. Basically, the message is that these roads are going to be built, but the task forces will be able to flesh out whatever environmental mitigation is needed, make sure that mass transit plays some role in these new highway corridors, and that economic development opportunities are appropriate and mindful of the road's impact on existing businesses. But it's all aimed at what was said repeatedly by state transportation department leaders who were steering the meetings. They were saying about how that consensus building needed to occur. Well, I guess the consensus being, around the idea that we're going to build these roads. But these task forces are really not going to be positioned to vote up or down on whether these roads get built. And that idea, the idea of stopping these roads, has some strong support among environmentalists. Here's Chris Costello with the Sierra Club of Florida speaking to one of the task forces earlier this week.
Neither the supporters nor the legislature has ever demonstrated the transportation need for these corridors. Task members, in our opinion, have been sent on a fool's errand. The only legitimate decision that could come from your work is to recommend no build. You have the opportunity to recommend no build, and we urge you to recommend no build.
Now, this was the first of what's going to be many task force meetings and public hearings, all leading up to a report next October from the task forces on the roads. But no matter what the task forces say, the law signed by DeSantis has a very strict bottom line, and that says that construction is to begin by 2022. So, you have to wonder, is this just window dressing, these task force meetings? Galvano says that these roads should tilt Florida toward its future, that they'll bring broadband access to rural communities that don't have it, jobs, and also he threw out the idea that they'll help the state achieve more coastal resilience and be ready for electric cars, mass transit, all that. But it's hard to overcome what seems to be a strong force of Floridians that just don't want these last stretches of Florida to become developed with a major highway running right through them.
One of the interests, so it sounds like this is kind of a done deal. I guess there was a little bit of ambiguity about whether maybe these task forces might eventually recommend, we don't necessarily need one or more of these roads. But it sounds like this is moving forward no matter what. What about the routes for these roads? I mean, that's kind of been up in the air. They've been really sort of vague, like we're going to go from here to here, but there's no real, this is the path we're going to take. Are these task forces going to determine that, or is this kind of something that FDOT is going to do and kind of run it through these task forces? I mean, it's kind of interesting, yeah. Especially the one from Lakeland to Collier. I'm sure a lot of people in that and those communities and all across that part of Florida are sort of wondering where a big new highway is going to go there. I guess we're going to find that out by next year when they submit this final report.
Yeah, I think that seems to be the idea that I get the impression that Florida Department of Transportation, over the course of these public hearings as they go forward and task force meetings, that it's going to become evident, well, here's the best way to go. Something tells me that there probably is a, well, here's the best way to go already being mapped out somewhere in the confines of this state's Department of Transportation offices. But for now, the only thing that has been laid out is a very broad corridor, for these roads, the one going from the Suncoast Parkway, like in the Hernando County area, up through northwest Florida, the mostly rural counties, Taylor, Jefferson, heading up toward the Georgia line. That is still murky, but I think that is to a certain degree to tamp down potential controversy among the public if they learn that a road is actually going to come, right down this highway or this stretch of the county, and also to maybe blunt what would be, early development opportunities along the way. So right. I think these roads are going to start emerging at some point as the logical way to go. There will be a route, but I don't think we're going to see that for coming months.
John, one thing that I thought was really interesting about your story was a statement by, I believe it was a woman up in kind of north of Tampa area, maybe Taylor County or around there, where the Suncoast Parkway extension is going. And she was saying that people were concerned in that area about a big new highway that would bypass all the businesses in the small towns along the way that currently, I think it's Highway 19 that goes up through there, and that goes through these downtowns, and it slows down to whatever 25, 30 miles an hour, and people have a chance to see some of the businesses and maybe stop and get some ice cream or get a lunch or buy something in some of these businesses, and that these highways are going to bypass these towns and potentially kill some of the business in there. And I thought that was fascinating because Galvano and others have really sold these roads as huge for economic development in these areas. They will make it easier to access these regions, that these rural areas that have been overlooked and that have not shared in some of the economic prosperity that we've seen in Florida and across the country. And they've pitched this as a way to alleviate traffic, but also to bring economic development and progress to some of these communities. But it sounds like not everybody really views this as progress.
Yeah, that's a good point. Clearly there's going to be winners and losers coming out of this. And just as these roads are the biggest highway expansion Florida has seen since the days of the Florida's Turnpike being created in the mid-1950s, you can look at Florida and see, the remnants of what the emergence of the highway system has led to, like along the lines of on Florida's East Coast, you can look at US 1, once dotted with little mom and pop hotels and, smaller scale, like, roadside attraction kind of businesses. Sure. Once US 1 became not the way to get to Miami, once I-95 came through, those businesses along US 1 started drying up, and, the economic conversion happened where a lot of them got run down. They got, rented to, lower income people that were living week to week. The whole economic face of a community would change. And I think, like we heard this week from that was a Taylor County commissioner that was speaking about the potential impact on her community with US 19 in a mostly rural area. I think she had some of those same concerns, seeing what would happen to the existing businesses in her hometown.
Yeah, it just goes to show that even on, there's a lot of the opposition has been from environmentalists. Roads have all kinds of impacts, and the environmentalists are concerned about the environmental impacts and how it could change these ecosystems and, sort of fracture them and make it more difficult for some of these species to access, the areas that they need to live, but there's also, even on the economic front, and that's really where a lot of people have been pitching these, there's drawbacks there as well. So these roads have a huge potential to impact parts of the state and really change the development patterns in the state. So it's something that we've covered through our Gatehouse Florida papers, and something that John has, I think, done a great job. Just personally, John, I think you've really covered this really well. So it's something that we'll continue to keep an eye on, just because it does really affect the state's future in a big way going forward. Okay, well, we'll move on to our final pick a number segment. John, your number was 11. You want to tell us what that's all about?
Yeah. I came in with my 11, and 11 is Article 11 of the Florida Constitution. That came into the news a little bit this week. They actually use the Roman numeral XI, this being the Constitution at all, but this is the section dealing with constitutional amendments. And the Florida House this week presented a kind of a novel argument to the state Supreme Court justices that they should take a closer look at citizen initiative amendments that add what could be considered state policy to the Constitution. Basically, the House says that these ballot amendments, which were very familiar with in Florida, you know, that they conflict with action that should be reserved for the legislature. That when the idea of raising petition signatures to get a ballot measure before voters was, when that was included in the 1968 Florida Constitution, it was really only to make changes to the existing Constitution, not to effectively enact legislation by popular vote. In arguments this week before the court, there was a controversial ballot proposal that would deregulate the electric utility industry, and that's vigorously opposed by the state's big four investor-owned utilities, who are, of course, major contributors to both political parties. That the House says that deregulation represents a policy decision that should be reserved for the legislature. It doesn't belong going before voters for a place in the state constitution, the House argued. Not only that, the House wants the court to start considering what it called a more textual approach to the interpretation of this Article 11 when it comes to putting measures on the ballot. Now this could signal, you know whether or not the justices enact this in this particular case is a unknown, but this could signal a real shift in Florida, where we've seen, you know, medical marijuana approved by voters, a requirement that a specific portion of the budget be spent on environmental programs, and of course, you know, the one that everyone ridicules, that pregnant pigs should not be kept in cages. Those were all the result of citizens' initiatives. But, you know, we now have three new justices on the seven-member court. They were appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis, who himself is not a big fan of constitutional amendments. The House may find the court, you know, ready to shift this balance of power back to the legislature. And they may say that, you know, look, this Article 11 has been, you know, misused in recent decades. Now, we all know that most of these proposed amendments emerge out of frustration with a legislature that doesn't respond to the wishes of the people. But the House is arguing that the ideas about direct democracy were rejected by the 1968 framers of the state constitution, but that case law, you know, precedent has opened the door to too many of these policy ideas. So the utility deregulation was the first of a half dozen ballot proposals for next year that justices are expected to rule on in coming weeks. And so it'll be interesting to see if the House argument gets any attention before these justices.
Well, we've talked on this show before about how the GOP-controlled legislature has been very critical of this constitutional amendment process, which allows voters to go around the legislature and enact laws directly. We covered the bill that they passed this year to sort of put some new restrictions on the constitutional amendment process, and now it sounds like they're making some interesting court arguments to try and curb this process. So, full frontal assault on this these ballot proposals, which is have enacted huge changes, as you pointed out, John, to Florida law. So this is important stuff to keep an eye on, because it really could affect the citizens' ability to change the state law going forward. Well, my number is 20,000. That's the number of insurance claims that last year's Hurricane Michael generated that are still unpaid as of the recording of this podcast. As Dorian approaches, it's worth noting that we're still dealing with the damage from Hurricane Michael, which devastated the Panama City region last year. Michael caused an estimated $7 billion in insured losses, and 14% of all claims have yet to be paid, according to a recent article in the Tampa Bay Times, even though state law requires claims to be paid within 90 days. State officials have said the large number of unpaid claims is concerning. Now that Dorian is threatening, we could see another big burst of insurance claims in Florida. It raises the question, will they be paid on time? I guess we'll see. But it's really important because this money is critical for people who are trying to rebuild and get their lives back in order after a storm. If you have damage to your roof, that can run into the thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, and people don't have that money sitting around. If they can't get these insurance claims paid, they can't repair their properties and move on with their lives. So it's an important issue to watch, especially as another hurricane threatens the state. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Porty, Joseph Forzano, Adam Fish, and Chandler Hopeful. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.